WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamita Basu. To round out our hour of coverage of Walt Whitman's legacy on his 200th birthday, and to anticipate our upcoming hour on LGBTQ plus history in honor of Pride Month, which starts tomorrow, we turn now to a new book of Whitman's poems. It's called Live Oak with Moss, and inside you'll not only find a cluster of 12 poems, but also a series of images by Caldecott-winning illustrator Brian Selznick. The book is notable not only for its stunning visual presentation, but also for the topics that this cluster of little-known Whitman poems addresses. These writings were never published altogether in their original form in his lifetime, and they reveal intimate reflections on love, specifically love between two men. Joining me now, illustrator Brian Selznick and Karen Carbiner, a professor at NYU. Brian, Karen, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thank you. So happy to be here.
Hey, yeah, thank you so much.
Now, Brian is here in front of me in the studio. Karen is by phone. But Brian, I want our listeners to understand the poetry a little bit more before we get into your illustration. So Karen, I'm going to start with you, even though you technically wrote the afterword. Can you explain what this collection of poems is, since Whitman never published them as they appear here in this grouping?
Well, Whitman had kept his own private notebook, and he titles it Live Oak with Moss. And in this tiny notebook, which we replicate to size in the book, he inscribed 12 very personal poems. And those 12 personal poems, he decided he did not want to share with the world, so he cut them up and rearranged them, edited some of them, and so they appeared in some part in his Calamus cluster in the 1860 edition. But as you were saying before, Live Oak with Moss as a body of 12 poems, as a cluster, really never, he never published them, and they never appeared during his lifetime.
So when was he working on these 12 poems?
That's a really good question, because I think there is a really important backdrop to when he wrote. We think he wrote these around 1858, 59, right before he's getting to his third edition of Leaves of Grass. And that's a really critical time for him, because he is hanging out at a cellar bar near the corner of Bleecker and Broadway called Foss, which is a tremendously permissive space. And we think he meets his first serious love interest there, a guy named Fred Vaughn, who drove an omnibus down the streets of New York. But there might be a foreground, and this is something Brian and I talked a lot about when we were thinking about how to depict Live Oak with Moss. Because a live oak with moss, a live oak tree, is a southern tree. It grows only in the South. They're not, you know, they're not up in New York at all. And Whitman had this peculiar 3-month sojourn down in New Orleans in 1848.
I like how you describe it as peculiar, but that's exactly what it is, right? What do we know about what he did in New Orleans?
Well, we don't know a lot. Uh-huh. He was writing for a newspaper. His dear brother Jeff came with him, so the two brothers were really exploring New Orleans. But there are all sorts of theories that the first time he really gets out of the radius of his family, and he's from this huge dysfunctional family, right? 8 children and alcoholic father, the parents are basically illiterate, and Whitman always around, always helping. But in 1848, he gets sick and tired of New York because he's fired from the Brooklyn Daily Eagle for his radical politics, and he just takes off for New Orleans. Mm. And, you know, New Orleans is smaller than New York. I think at that time it was the 5th largest city in the country, but it was a really interesting place where races met and sexuality was an interesting, more fluid issue, perhaps. And Whitman seems to have indulged, at least some of his journalism suggests this, with going to clubs and watching performances of people named things like Miss Dusky Grisette. But the old Whitman lore used to say that something happened to Walt, that maybe he wound up sleeping with someone he thought was a woman who wound up being a man and found himself that way. All we know is that for some reason, those photographs taken right around 1848 differ so much with the Whitman that we see later. Like something loosens up for him around this time. He loses his dandy-esque look, you know, the sort of bad yearbook askance kind of getaway expression. And he really finds himself, you know, he's this handsome, broad-shouldered, almost aggressively sexual guy when you look at his 1854 frontispiece.
Do we know anything about why he left New Orleans and came back to New York after, right?
Yeah, he was really attached to family. And I think the mere fact that he brought his brother down was kind of a sign he knew he would go back because it was a younger brother and, you know, he just had to return him to the family. And Whitman was really the center of the family. So especially when Whitman Sr. dies, but even before that, Whitman is the bread and butter. He's the sanity of the family. And he lives with his family through his 40s. So I don't think there was a doubt that he would come back, but I think something happened that he picked up the thread 10 years later when he discovered this place called Pfaff's, where he could really kind of, you know, explore himself. That was also the place where allegedly the first gay men's club in America called the Fred Gray Association started meeting there. So Whitman had this new inroad to other ways of thinking. He was always a loner before this, but something about that community and the permissiveness of the space opened him up to write these extraordinary poems.
And Karen, I want to come back to those concepts in just a moment. But first, I want to ask Brian about the illustrations in the book, because the bulk of the book is really made up of your detailed illustrations. And in your short introduction, you explain, Brian, that this book is both dedicated to and maybe sort of against the wishes of Maurice Sendak, the famed illustrator. So can you describe what you meant by that?
I think he'd like that description. I met Maurice, who had really been my artistic hero at a time when I was feeling somewhat frustrated with my work. I had just finished a big children's book about Walt Whitman, which was very hard to do because there's nothing about Walt Whitman's life or work that's appropriate for children. But I figured out how to do that. And by coincidence, when I met Maurice, he was reading Leaves of Grass for the first time and was really, for the first time, accepting and talking publicly about his own homosexuality. And so that was really what we first bonded over was Walt Whitman. And one day when I was visiting him in Connecticut, Maurice told me this story, the one that Karen tells us, and from Maurice's point of view, the way Maurice described it to me is that there was this secret group of poems about a love affair Whitman had with another man that he never published as he wrote them. As Karen said, cut them up, rearranged them, hid them in Leaves of Grass, and no one knew about them for 100 years till they were discovered in the 1950s. And of course, like, you know, that's a profoundly intriguing setup and an incredibly strange story that also, in a way, sort of parallels the act of secretly being gay and then coming out and being and taking what's secret to you and making it public. And so I'm also a puppeteer. And so I made an adult toy theater erotic puppet show based on this story, which was in a lot of ways the exploration of the things that I couldn't explore or had trouble
you're
exploring.
Saying all these words as if you're guessing at it or you're offering it, but you did this very specific thing. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, there was a reason.
Yeah.
And so I made this dirty little puppet show for grown-ups, for a grown-up audience, that all took place in a 3x5-inch opening in a suitcase, and then it was a live video feed to make this private puppet show into a public performance. And a musician named Robert Ean wrote music, setting some of the poems to song. He sang it live, and I performed this. And Karen had seen this show, and as 2019 was approaching, we started talking about making this into a book. But as you were saying, Maurice, when he told me about these poems, he said that he had been thinking about illustrating them. Someone had been encouraging him to illustrate them, but he didn't believe poetry should ever be illustrated because he said when he's illustrating, he's not actually trying to illustrate a story. He's trying to illuminate it so that what he does with the pictures becomes necessary to the reader when you're experiencing the words and the pictures together. And poetry, he says, is something that happens between the poet and the reader, and an illustration would get in its way, would get in the way of that connection. And so after he passed away and we were talking about making this into a book, I had this, you know, dictum from Maurice saying you can't illustrate poetry. So as you were saying, the idea is that I think there's like 150 drawings in the book, and they trace the arc of the story. There's a metaphoric resonance with the poems, but when you get to the poems, which are in the middle of the drawings, the poems themselves appear without any imagery. The lead up to them gives us just the poems. So the idea is that they're like a lens or a framework that we do try to, that we, hopefully the reader can see the poems through. And in a way, for readers who maybe are afraid of poems or uncomfortable with poetry, the visual framework gives you a solid base from which to hopefully understand the poem, so that when you get to the poem that talks about a live oak tree, you will remember seeing a live oak tree. Or when you're reading about the Passion, you might remember the page of flames that appears earlier, or the sad moments when Whitman's talking about being alone, you might remember the imagery of the room that fills up with snow. So that it's not a direct connection with what Whitman said and what I'm drawing, but it's hopefully evoking the ideas.
The experience of turning the pages of this book is really so delightful, and it's hard to describe, but I'm going to try, and then I'd like you to keep describing it. But it's not a flip book by any means, but page by page, there is movement, there's action, there's zooming into details that give way to these vibrant colors splashed across entire spreads. And then there's some very intimate illustrations that are just close-ups of flesh on flesh, of bodies pressed together. Describe what you were creating here as a page-by-page experience. Like you said, before you even get to the poems.
You know, Whitman talked a lot in his poetry about the book as a body, and that the thing in your hand is him. And Karen and I both really love the book as an object. And another mentor of mine is an illustrator named Remy Sharlip, and he wrote an essay called The Page is a Door. And it's all about what happens every time you turn the page in a book. It's a moment of revelation. And that possibility, you know, books are a limited technology. They open, you can turn the page, but within that technology, you can do anything. And so I was thinking a lot also about The Wild Rumpus and Where the Wild Things Are.
Sure.
Where, you know, the reader, I'm sure all of the listeners can close their eyes and picture The Wild Rumpus, where there's no more words, there's no more white space, and we just flip through those pages of The Wild Rumpus as Max and the Wild Things, you know, play underneath the moon. And thinking about every time you turn the page in Live Oak with Moss, and you're moving from one image to another, one idea to another, and these ideas about how things reveal themselves, how things transform. You know, there's moments in the book where there's the flames I had mentioned, and then over the next like five pages, a flood rises up, filling the page with water, and then clouds appear as the water transforms into the sky. And then the snowy room that I described earlier, once the room completely fills up with snow, we're left with a page that's just entirely white.
I really like that series.
Oh, thank you.
It was beautiful.
Thank you. You know, and then that white page, when you turn, becomes the first page of the poems. So the poems actually are built on what is conceptually a physical space. It's a physical space of that room, of snow, of the pages. And that idea of everything constantly being revealed page by page by page by page felt like it was something that tracked with and evoked all of the ideas that we've been talking about already and that Whitman was working with in the poems.
Karen, let's go back to the poems for a moment, because you were describing these sort of pivotal moments in Walt Whitman's life that may have led to him wanting to write these poems, his own revelations about love for another man. But you also write that attempting a pure autobiographical reading of these poems is pretty futile and that we shouldn't attempt to do it. Why is that? Can we not assume that these poems are largely autobiographical? Oh, Karen, are you still with us? Sorry, we might have lost Karen for a moment there, but we'll wait and try and get her back on the line.
She's calling from the Whitman birthplace, so she's currently there with people, and so maybe Whitman intervened.
Where exactly is the Whitman birthplace?
I think it's we're going to have to let Karen answer
We'll ask her.
Exactly. I don't want to give wrong information, but I know she's there, and I've been thinking a lot about Mrs. Whitman giving birth to him today.
Wow. Yeah. Sure. Brian, you mentioned that you've done a children's book about Walt Whitman. What was your point of entry into your interest in him?
I for some reason, had for years collected editions of Leaves of Grass, but I had never read it. And I think I knew that he was queer, and I think there was something about that connection that I felt like I wanted, that made me want to have the objects of the books on my shelf. And then I was approached by an author named Barbara Curley, who wanted to do a sort of a birth to death picture book biography of Whitman for kids. And so that was really my impetus to dive into Leaves of Grass finally. And I read the first edition of Leaves of Grass, which, like Live Oak with Moss, had 12 poems. And then the deathbed edition, because he, as you've talked about today, he worked on Live Oak with Moss for the rest of his life. And it had, I think, over 600 poems in it. And I read both of them. And
Leaves of Grass, you mean.
Leaves of Grass, thank you. Yeah. And I just fell in love with it. I was overwhelmed. I saw myself in it in many different ways. And, you know, but the idea that trying to find the thing that's appropriate for kids is, you know, mm-hmm. always what I'm trying to do. And because, as we said, his work wasn't appropriate for kids, his life, that these themes. But I was working on the book as the Iraq War was starting, and I was listening to the radio, and there were stories about young soldiers coming back and their injuries. And I was looking at Whitman's work as a Civil War nurse, which I know you mm-hmm. also talked about today, and realizing that Whitman took that pain and turned it into art. And that's something children would understand, taking mm-hmm. pain and making it into art. So that was sort of the entryway into the book itself. But then as I was drawing the pictures, I was also very conscious of Whitman's queerness and things that weren't necessarily directly addressed in the text, but that can be felt throughout the images.
Karen, I hear you humming along to us, so I know that you're there now. I wanted to ask you about whether or not we can read these poems as being indicative of Whitman's life and his own experiences, because you talked about him going to New Orleans and having this sort of awakening in his own sexual understanding of himself. Why do you warn against reading these poems as being autobiographical?
Well, it's an easy out, right, to say that it's just about one person, when I think the reason that Brian and I, you know, grabbed onto these poems is that they are about everybody. They're incredible poems about a time before the word homosexual even existed, and Whitman was really struggling to figure out his identity and come to terms with these feelings that he had for other men. And as these first sustained attempts to write about the naturalness of love beyond traditional heteronormative boundaries, they are just amazing poems. So one benefit we get from remembering never to conflate the eye of the text with the author is that these poems could be about us. And in fact, I've taught these poems for many years before we decided to treat them this way, and my students have gravitated towards them. You know, they're so brave and honest and really raw. And I think for Brian and me, we really wanted to bring these very complicated poems to the public. And Brian, you said before, it's hard to do that, right? It's difficult to crack open the key to read poems. So I love the way that the book begins with his illustrations. And we've already heard from readers who feel like, okay, this is kind of like a beautiful, gentle, subtle way of getting into the poetry. And then they come to the poems, and all of a sudden those images that they had been reading about pop up in the text. And then if they want to go deeper, they can go into my afterword. And then finally, which we both really love, we have reconstituted the Live Oak with Moss manuscript at the end of the text. So you can go entering very gently into these very complicated poems about identity, right? He's really trying to establish his own definition of same-sex love in these poems. And he's dreaming about this idea of a supportive community of lovers more than 100 years before today's LGBTQ rights movement. So there's an enormous amount of bravery in these poems and privacy, right? These were not meant for our eyes. And yet, that was really what Brian and I thought this year, not only of Whitman's 200th birthday, but also Pride Month, and really thinking about that landmark, that maybe we're ready to hear this message that Whitman probably felt the world wasn't ready for in 1860.
My guests have been Brian Selznick and Karen Carbiner. The edition of Live Oak with Moss, illustrated by Brian and with an essay by Karen, is available now. I understand both of you have some events coming up on June 6th. You'll be at the Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn. On June 11th, you'll be at the Brooklyn Historical Society. You can catch them there. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamita Basu. We'll be right back after the news.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.